Maxine, get your...
Kanima, mo, kanima, mo, freli, mo, kanima, mo, kanima, parece a bancada não canta bem. A bancada não canta bem, já estragaram o povo. Canimambo, canimambo, frelimo.
Canimambo, canimambo, frelimo.
Canimambo,
canimambo, frelimo.
Canimambo,
frelimo.
Canimambo,
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 frelimo.
Canimambo,
canimambo,
frelimo.
Gita Chula,
Gita Chula,
Gita Chula,
Gita Chula,
Gita Chula.
Good evening and welcome to Amandla, 1 hour of African Affairs, brought to you here on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, CQUT.ca around the world. I am sitting here virtually with Doug Miller and... Doug, boy, you really took it away this week again with a focus on Mozambique, a place I hold very dear to my heart. Tell us more.
All of us who were involved in the anti-apartheid struggle had nothing but great admiration for Samora Machel. And the music you heard at the beginning was him leading the singing of a large crowd of Mozambicans. Alan and Barbara Isaacman have produced a book, Mozambique's Samora Machel, A Life Too Short. So he's a professor of history, actually the founder of the history department at Mozambique, the University of Mozambique, Edward Mondlane, at the very beginning of Mozambique's independence. And his wife was with the women's section of Frelimo, working on all sorts of everything from laws and any number of ways to break patriarchy and help women's independence or development and strength within the struggle. So I interviewed Alan Isaacman, and Uli Gierstad joined us, and he of course has a long background in Mozambique. So it's a wonderful long interview, but I think you'll enjoy it. And so stay tuned to Amandla. I'm here tonight with Alan Isaacman, Dr. Alan Isaacman, professor. He'll explain his role in academia in a minute. And with our old friend and comrade, Uli Gierstad, who's collaborated with us for the many, many years that Amandla's been on the radio. And Alan and his partner, Barbara, have just produced a book called Mozambique's Samora Machel, A Life Too Short. And it's I have just read it, and I must say I am extremely enthusiastic and extremely excited to talk to Alan. Alan, could you just introduce yourself to our listeners and give us a little bit of your background, and then lead us into what you and Barbara, what led you to do this book?
Sure. First of all, I have to send you Barbara's greetings and regrets. She's currently involved in a major case to fight a deportation of an Ethiopian and who was incarcerated by ICE for 3 years, and she's doing some legal work right now. So she joins us in spirit and solidarity, but not in fact.
Well, thank you so much.
So Bobby and I have a long history with Frelimo and with Samora Machel. But let me step back for a second and just say that I got involved in work on Mozambique and Southern Africa when I was an undergraduate at City College in New York, located in Harlem. And at that point, I realized I was majoring in what I wanted to major in and study was African American history, which was then called the history of the Negro people. And I was told there's no such thing. but that there is this new emerging field in early 60s called African history. And would I be interested? And not appreciating the differences and being very young and enthusiastic, I said yes. At the same time, I was doing work involved in the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement. My father had a little sporting goods store in the Bronx. It was really a ma and pa and me store. And across the street was a Woolworths. Now, Woolworths in those days was being boycotted and picketed across the country because in the South, their lunch counters were segregated. So I would go from picketing to work, and my father would be furious at me because he said business and politics don't mix and I'm driving customers away. Well, business and politics are one and the same, though I didn't quite realize it at that point. But so what I realized early on is that I had a love for Africa, but I couldn't be just an academic. And at the same time, I couldn't be just an activist. It was a part of me that needed to do both. And so when I went to graduate school at the University of Wisconsin, I was involved in the anti-apartheid movement and was looking to figure out what I could do, what contribution I could make. And it was at that point that I discovered Mozambique. And virtually nothing had been written about the history of Mozambique. The Portuguese denied Africans had a history, and the only thing that had been written was about Europeans, Portuguese in Mozambique. So I realized there was an enormous opening intellectually, but also there was an armed struggle going on. And I saw this as a way of helping to liberate the Mozambican past from the classism, sexism, and particularly the cultural arrogance and racism of the Portuguese. In 1967, Bobby and I went to Portugal and to Mozambique. The Portuguese government let us in because they were victims of their own mythology. They had constructed this idea that they were uniquely colorblind. And they used Brazil as an example as compared to the United States to show how Portuguese colonies were different. They also claimed to be people of color because in the 9th century, there was a Moorish invasion from North Africa. And they argued, how can we be racist if we have black blood, whatever that means. In any case, they allowed us in, believing that they could convince us that they were non-racialists, and theirs was a unique experience in Portugal. Mozambique was part of their overseas. Well, we spent 2 years collecting oral histories, which they allowed us to do because they thought that these were simply myths and legends, to quote them, and therefore posed no serious problem. And in fact, we observed the end of the long history of forced labor and brutality and dehumanizing of Africans. And when we came back to the United States in 1970, I immediately got in touch with Sharfuddin Khan, who is the Mozambican representative to the United Nations. And thereafter to the fledging Committee for a Free Mozambique, which was located in New York, I appeared before Congress on several occasions in my academic hat, arguing for the independence of Mozambique and why the United States should not be supporting the Portuguese regime. And I became very active in that committee and worked closely with Mozambicans. And right after independence, Bobby was then finishing law school, were invited by the president to come to Mozambique to teach Mozambicans history and for Bobby to work in the Mozambican women's movement and also to help, and she worked with Albie Sachs to rewrite the labor laws. So if you ever want to know, I tell my students what it means to be underdeveloped is when an African country, newly independent, has to rely on a white guy from the Bronx to teach them their history, because the Portuguese suppressed and denied their history. Fanon was absolutely right when he said the hardest legacy and the most evil dimension of colonialism is colonizing the mind. So Bobby and I went there. We worked for 2 years there, met the most magnificent people, including a number of comrades from Canada, including John Saul, Judith Marshall, Barry Minsky, George Povey, and others. And I use the word comrades intentionally, purposefully, because we had and shared a dream of helping Mozambique become not only liberated, but then to become a socialist nation and to continue their work in the struggle for the liberation of Zimbabwe, Namibia, and South Africa. So I wear these two hats, and I wear them both proudly as an Africanist and as an engaged activist and scholar. I've written 9 books on various aspects of the history of Mozambique. I always felt that my greatest contribution was both training graduate students from Africa, and I've trained happily, and I say this with great pride, more historians of Africa from Africa than anyone else, maybe in the world, but certainly in North America. And I remain very committed to the struggles going on in social justice in Mozambique. When I say I'm really talking about Bobby and myself.
Wow, what a history. That's amazing. So from the early 60s through to 1975 was independence, June
right.
25th, if I'm not mistaken.
25th, yep.
And mm-hmm. and so for that earlier period, you were involved as an activist, and you mentioned that the United States should stop supporting Portugal. How was it supporting Portugal?
Well, so the United States, so what are the interesting things is in the early 1960s, several of the leaders of Frelimo came to the United States to meet with the Kennedys, but particularly they met with Bobby Kennedy. They presumed that the United States would support them. They were led at this time by Eduardo Mondlane, who was married to a white American woman who had a PhD from Northwestern, who was a very proud nationalist. And he believed, and the others believed, that their struggle for majority rule was no different than the civil rights movement, one person, one vote in the United States. And therefore, they expected to be well received by the Kennedys. And they were shocked when they were rebuffed. And the reason they were rebuffed is because the United States didn't care about majority rule. Southern Africa was only important in the context of the Cold War. Portugal was important because it provided the United States with a major naval base in the Azores to track the Soviet Navy. And so the United States supported Portugal, a NATO ally, rather than supporting any principle, and provided arms, intelligence, and military, and all sorts of assistance to the Portuguese throughout that period.
And speaking as a Canadian, I might add that Canada was as complicit.
I don't think it was quite as complicit, but it certainly was complicit. All the NATO countries were. The most complicit, I think, were probably Germany, France, Britain, and the United States.
And then you let it slip so smoothly, but we were invited by the president to come in. How did you get invited by the president of Mozambique?
Well, we had met. To say as the president, maybe it was certainly by him, but by others too. What had happened, and ultimately the invitation came from the rector of the university, because Frelimo was very much into structures and lines of authority. But in 1974, my first book came out, and it won an award, an extremely prestigious award from the African Studies Association, the Herskovitz Award. And I donated a portion of that money to Frelimo publicly, and also pushed the association to move from a non-political position to support the armed struggles in Guinea-Bissau, Angola, and Mozambique. I got this check, and I sent it off to President Michel, not knowing if he would ever, you know, acknowledge it, recognize it, or anything. And he did get it, because I found the letter that I sent with him in his personal papers.
Oh, boy.
And so, and I said that I would love to come and teach in Mozambique, and the rest is history.
Amazing history, I might add, as well, because you were right there at the foundation of Edward Mondlane University, and I presume it was the history department that you were involved in. And
yes, I was, and in fact, some of the most senior historians in Mozambique today were my first students.
What a history, what a history. Bravo, Alan. Bravo.
One of Alan's students, I think, was Yusuf Adam.
Yes, Yusuf Adam. He was in the first class, yes.
Yeah, and he became a very valuable contributor on the English language radio station that we opened up in 1980. In Mozambique, Yusuf was always there to give us a really good perspective on Mozambique in history, following along the lines that you were describing, Alan, of, you know, rewriting Mozambique's history for Mozambicans.
Right. So Ali is being modest. He and Ian Christie and Francis Christie and others from South Africa played a critical role and Radio Mozambique, beaming it into South Africa, beaming it previously into colonial Rhodesia, Namibia. So it was an extraordinarily important work. And those of you who might be interested in reading my book and Bobby's book, Mozambique, Some More Michelle, A Life Cut Short, which is published by Ohio University Press, should also read Ian Christie's book. Because Ian Christie, who worked with Ali, who's a Scot, he's from Scotland, and joined and was in Frelimo in the 1970s in Dar es Salaam and came down, he played a critical role in helping to set up information. He was a journalist in Scotland, then worked for Frelimo, and he was very important in training a whole group of Mozambicans. So one of our goals that Ali played, and Ian, myself, and many other cooperants, was not just filling in gaps, because so few Mozambicans had college degrees or because of the Portuguese colonial system, but also training, which was very important, a new generation of Mozambicans. That was our most important goal. Was really to do that in every field, whether it was George Povey in medicine, Barry Minsky, I can't remember what field he was in.
He was an architect.
Architect, right. He worked with Roberta Washington, architect. So it was not just doing the necessary work to keep the country going, because we have to remember at independence, less than 3 or 4% of the Mozambican population was literate. And Mozambique had perhaps two or three economists in the whole country. The head of the National Bank, what we in the United States would call the Federal Reserve today, was a guy named Parakash, who was 28 years old. These were young kids. They had more education. They had studied in Portugal or in some cases the Soviet Union, but mostly in Portugal or France. These were young kids who were getting their feet wet. They had to... they were extraordinarily committed and smart, but they didn't have a lot of on-the-ground experience. And that's why some of us who are a little older were able to help fill in every ministry. You would find Western cooperants. And that's a very interesting word, because it juxtaposes how Mozambique and Frelimo saw us as opposed to in Malawi or Ghana, where people there were expatriates working there. We were cooperators. We were working alongside of the revolution, and we were treated with great appreciation and respect and as comrades in most situations. There were obviously some situations in a workplace where only people who were actually in Frelimo were allowed to participate in some things, but generally we were treated with great admiration and respect, and we learned an enormous amount.
I think we're talking about Samora Machel here and the book you and Barbara have written, Alan. And I think, you know, Samora, President Samora, was a larger than life figure. He was a beacon, you know, for progressives. And that is why I think a lot of people came to Mozambique as cooperantes and qualified people. And sometimes I've thought back on it. For example, when in the early 80s, when we were there, some of the Montrealers who were there, this being a Montreal radio station, André Joff designed Mozambique's first census. This is at the, you know, there were hardly any computers.
Right.
You know, he worked with young Mozambicans who had maybe 9 years of schooling and so on. And this was the first census. I think it was in 1981.
It was carried off.
This is the plan on which Mozambique is building its future. Mm-hmm. You know, health, education, economy. André Joff was key in there. And then there was Jean Menard. He was an engineer at Hydro-Québec.
Right.
And during the worst periods of the South African-led war of destabilization of Mozambique, Jean had a team of maybe three or four guys, and they kept the city of Beira, Mozambique's second city, with electricity.
Uh-huh.
As pylons were being blown up, as power stations were being hit with rockets, you know?
Yep.
And it's people like that came to Mozambique and stayed sometimes for quite a long time because of much of what Samora represented.
Yeah, and you
Samora
know...
Samora created.
You're listening to Amandla here on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, CKUT.ca around the world. And please do check out the best of Amandla on our blog, which is amandla.ca.
So, Ollie, you're right. It's not only that people were drawn there by Samora's vision and Frelimo's vision, but some people stayed for life and became Mozambican citizens. Ian Christie and Francis are one, but there are also a number from the Nordic countries as well. But two things that you said that were very important. One has to do, and we'll get back to this, with South Africa destabilization. And South Africa, I would contend, responsibility for the murder of Samora Machel. They had to South Africans had to destabilize Mozambique and ultimately kill Samora because they could not have a black socialist on their borders, governing on their borders, especially one who had such a following, not only across the world. After all, Mozambique is a very inconsequential country, and yet he figured prominently with Ortega, with Yasser Arafat, with Castro, with other people, Sankara, with other people in the Non-Aligned Movement. He was extremely significant and consequential, but mostly where he was most consequential was in South Africa. Now, one of the images that I have from 1976 at the Soweto uprising, where all the African high school students went on strike, is even though they could not speak a word of English, they all had their fists raised and they were, a word of Portuguese, excuse me, and they were chanting "A luta continua," the struggle continues, which was the slogan from Frelimo. And they had pictures of some more, even which had been snuck into the country. And they, there's all this graffiti on the wall about Samora and Frelimo. So he really was an enormous symbol of liberation. And people ask why. And oh, you remember, I've never been at a political rally where the leader gets up and starts to sing.
That's right.
But at every rally, he would sing and his eyes would light up and he would draw the crowd in and people would just be so enthusiastic. Fidel Castro said in 1977, I think in Beira, that this guy is the only guy who won a revolution by singing. But he was also extraordinarily dynamic. The thing I loved about Samora was looking at his eyes. They were so powerful. Now, that's not to say he didn't have his own shortcomings. Of course he did. And he had a big ego. And we tell in the book several stories to illustrate his ego. But he, above all else, he was committed. He had a vision of a just Mozambican society, which comes out of his own lived experiences. And so when people say, was he really a Marxist? Was he really a socialist? The answer is yes. He lived the exploitation of colonial capitalism. And when he got to, and we talk about this a lot in our book, and when he got to Tanzania and to the Frelimo headquarters there, someone gave him a copy of Karl Marx. I don't remember, Das Kapital or something. And he was also an avid reader, by the way. And he started to read Marx. Yeah, I think it was Marx, maybe Lenin. And he said, you know, I'm reading this for the second time. And what he meant by that was he had lived it the first time. Mm. And so he was profoundly aware of the exploitation built into colonial capitalism, and he was deeply committed to non-racialism. And as I said, my kids benefited enormously from that.
I feel like this is a dumb question to ask at this point, because you've made clear your love and admiration for the man. But why the book now? It's almost 30 years since he died.
Oh, well, that's an interesting question, and the answer to that is in your question. And that is, I became acutely aware that young people were losing that history. That, like young people everywhere, they get fixed on social media. 20 years ago is boomboxes. And that history of the armed struggle and what was so significant about Mozambique was getting lost. And then after Samora's death and after Chissano's presidency, there was an enormous amount of corruption. And people became so disaffected. And I wanted them to understand their own roots and the struggle and the sacrifice of thousands of young boys and girls for them to become free, and that they should pass on this history to their children and children's children, because now those elders who were active members of Frelimo are passing away. So it seems like it's very important. And in fact, I'm in the process now, and this is going to be my last project, of writing a much fuller biography. I have been working with people in Russia, Cuba, and the former East German archives to get additional information on Samora, and I'm going to do more interviewing with some more of his age mates and comrades before they pass away. So part of it is to collect, to create an archive, and that's what we've done. And we've helped to, and there's also now this Samoa Michelle Documentation Center. But part of it is just to remind people and young people that things were different and things can be different again in the future.
I think that's important. When you consider, well, you know, today, whenever Mozambique appears in any news story that reaches a North American or a Western audience, it has to do with an insurgency in Cabo Delgado, the exit of multinational oil companies, and it's all very muddled, it's all very unclear, and a lot of it is about corruption, inequality of Mozambican leaders being responsible for the kind of background that allows an insurgency like this to happen. So we're talking about a whole era here. But one thing I found interesting in the book, Alan, is that, you know, Mozambique was almost destroyed by the South African campaign of destabilization, economic destruction, political trauma of the population, and so on. And that was, it was horrendous. We can't overestimate the damage that was done. But you say that by the time Zamora was killed in 1986, 35 years ago, it's a generation ago that that he died. He had spent most of his political capital. You don't say it exactly that, but his star was declining.
Yeah.
Did you sense that? I didn't sense that at the time.
No, well, so I would meet with Samora every year because I would go and do research, and on the way out, I would have sort of an exit visit with him. And it focused on three things, U.S. foreign policy and U.S. domestic policy, what RENAMO was doing in the South Africans, in the United States, among the evangelical far right, and the corruption that I observed in the countryside. He was very, very interested in that. He was very alert. I didn't sense his star waning because I didn't want to see it. So there's no question when you think about memory, you remember what you in part choose to remember. But it is quite clear that objectively his power and influence had diminished in several respects. But the military wasn't functioning well. The day before, he told me that when he was going to come back from Zambia, he intended to get rid of many of the old guard in the military who were not effective fighting the South Africans in RENAMO, and he was going to appoint a whole new generation of younger people. So he recognized that things weren't going well. There's no question, not only the military, the economy. He felt like the Soviets had let him down in a number of different ways, which I'd be happy to talk about. So yes, there is no question. You can't know what would have happened had Samora lived. But it is no question that his popular support and some important errors that he made in policy had a negative effect. Now, having said that, one of the things that you should know is in the last 20 years, that would be from about 2000 on, at the same time that successive governments essentially rendered him invisible, successive leaders to build up themselves, there was sort of a forgetting from the top. There was also a remembering from above, the bottom. Mm-hmm. And so Samora has enormous resurgence in the beginning of the 20th century in rap music and popular culture, but also on the street. People start talking about things. This wouldn't be happening. We wouldn't have corruption like this if Samora was here. Or Samora was harsh, but he cared about all of us. And so there's enormous appetite among at least a generation of people who are now in their 50s or so, who remember the hard years, because they were hard for sure, but who remember a sense of hope. The hope that Samora always conveyed was that through human agency and sacrifice, life would be better for your children and your grandchildren. That was the hope that he conveyed, and he could mobilize people based on that. But of course, after a while, as you said, Ollie, with the destabilization, the lack of support from the East, with very poor economic choices, decisions, the economy crashed and things started to get very bad, and hope gave way to cynicism and fear.
Yeah, there was real.
Of course.
We were at war, you know.
Yeah, and people, I have to emphasize this because I hold very clearly to this. I'm probably in a minority position that Renamo was created by Rhodesia and South Africa. It was an arm of the apartheid regime. Its purpose was to destabilize Mozambique, and it was only. And they did horrific things. I can remember young boys telling me, young boys who had been in Frelimo, in Renamo, and then turned themselves in and became street people in Maputo, that they were forced to cut off their mother's ears or breasts so that they would be, what's the right word? They would be isolated. Sure. From their own community. Ostracized, thank you, from their own community. And the only thing that they could do to survive was first to join Frelimo, Renamo, and commit all these atrocities. And then they snuck back to the city and were like city urchins. So the notion that Renamo has nationalist or anti-communist origins is absolutely false. What does happen by the mid-80s, maybe by 85 or 86, is that some areas, some Renamo commanders began to recognize that they had a political opening and began to take it. But throughout this whole period, Renamo was essentially an arm of South Africa's military.
Absolutely.
And armed and aided and abetted directly by them in all sorts of ways.
And aided and abetted directly by the United States, I should say, as well. Certainly the Department of DIA, Department of Intelligence, and the military provided a lot of covert tactical support for Renamo.
I was interested in your book by how the guerrillas that were Frelimo, the freedom fighters of the forest and the bush, had absorbed so much of the Mao philosophy of a freedom fighter is like a fish in the water. He has to know his people, has to be part of those people, have to work with them. And so they were very much a peasant-based movement because they were out in the bush. And that when they came face to face with city realities, they had a whole different approach to it, and in many cases weren't terribly sophisticated or aware of how they could and should deal with urban realities and the people who are real people too, just like peasants, but
right.
In the city.
Yeah. So they do have a strong Maoist well, peasant-based organization. They were trained in Nachingwea primarily by Chinese instructors. And Frelimo worked very hard to try to avoid getting caught in the Sino-Soviet disputes, and at various times bucked both of them. Bucked the Chinese, and certainly bucked the Soviets, because the Soviets wanted to have a naval base. For the Soviet Union, Mozambique was most important, not so much in terms of international solidarity, although the Soviet Union did provide enormous economic and military support at one point in the first several years. But for Soviet Union, the really important thing was that Mozambique was a platform into South Africa. That was really the Soviets' principal interest.
Well, let me rephrase my direction. And
oh, I'm
question.
Sorry.
The thing is that they then moved hundreds of maybe thousands of people from the city who were considered unproductive people, and resettled them in the remote regions of Cabo Delgado, Niassa, and the north.
Right.
I'm wondering if in that relocation, because I'm sure that wasn't exactly a happy time for so many of those people who were relocated.
It was a terrible time, and it was a terrible error in judgment and in policy.
Yeah,
that was one of the major mistakes that Frelimo made. It was, you know, Zamora has to take responsibility for everything that happened, good and bad. He was the president. That idea comes primarily from Gubuza, and who had been the political commissar in the war and had a very strong authoritarian tendencies. And it is true they had a social problem, and they had large numbers of unemployed people and homeless people. But to just take them, physically dump them, and sometimes dump people who were not homeless and unemployed into Nyasa, where there were no facilities, by the way. It was, they sent them to these places that were called re-education camps, but they weren't even there. Bobby and I went there. They were essentially, there was no barbed wire. They were in the middle of nowhere. We only went to one, but other people have been there, have confirmed this. And they were just left there to become farmers, to survive. And the social cost to so many families that were disrupted was enormous. So it was a very foolish policy, and violated one of Frelimo's fundamental principles, that you don't give arms to the enemy, because it created a lot of alienation both in Maputo and Beira, where families were shipped off sometimes, and also Renamo was able to take advantage of that.
Well, then let me bring it to today, because we know what's happening in Cabo Delgado, again, one of the furthest parts of Mozambique from the central headquarters in Maputo and Beira. We've seen what's happening. Do you think there's any connection between that past and the current events today?
If that past, you mean the past of Zamora, no, I don't. What I do think is when Chissano became president, for a short time, he flirted with the idea and tried to figure out a way of connecting the best dimensions of Mozambique's socialist project in terms of education, health, etc., with the market economy. But the pressure from the West and the World Bank and the IMF was so strong that that ended very quickly, and he had to privatize. Everything was privatized. Once that happens, once you have privatization, the story changes 100%, because a lot of the guerrilla commanders, a lot of the leaders didn't have any education, but now everything was commodified. Everything was a commodity. So the only thing that they had going for them was their political connections. And when everything became privatized, they began to use their political connections to get land, to have influence in private companies that were organized. And it's from that moment on. So the legacy of neoliberalism is what is occurring today in northern Mozambique. Now, it's not unique to Mozambique. Anytime you have oil, gas, whether it's Angola, Nigeria, etc., Libya, you have this enormous amount of social dislocation, growing inequality, and a small number of people prospering, a lot of people suffering. Moreover, you have a lot of displacement when you're having all this new infrastructure being built and people forced out of their homes, which created an opening for Al-Shabaab or whatever Muslim fundamentalists, some of whom had been very hostile to Frelimo when it was socialist, some of whom had gone to study in Saudi Arabia, but they took advantage of the explicit and unbridled capitalism. It was the most classic example of vulture capitalism, whatever the appropriate term is, which again created an opening, which these Islamicists and terrorists are using. But Frelimo doesn't have very much capital and has done very little to protect people. And if you don't have much capital, social capital, if you're not protecting your citizens and you're seen as corrupt, and the possibility of turning this around is not great. I'm very pessimistic. It's not that I think they're going to take over anything, but I do think that sort of low-grade destabilization is going to continue. And of course, who suffers are the men and women, young and old peasants in the north, which had been the least developed part of the country before. And so Frelimo never gave them very much. Now, there were some Frelimo leaders from the north who now are extremely prosperous. But that's one of the fun things that I found most unsettling, is that people who I admired, some people who I admired, went on this whole other, pursued this whole other trajectory of corruption and self-enrichment. I have to say, on the other hand, there are a number of Frelimo people who didn't pursue that. We don't hear anything about them. People like Ali would know, George Ribello.
My first boss.
Yeah, and your first boss, right?
Yeah, yeah.
My wife's
boss.
I know that. He was a difficult person, but he was extremely, extremely principled and still is today. And I can name 50 other people. But the people at the very top, the Gabuzes, the people around him, just Gabuza became like Mobutu.
Yeah.
He was one of those profiteers, wasn't he? Who?
Yes.
Yeah. He was, you could see it early on. He was the governor of Sofala, I think.
Yes.
Having a hard time in the war. And it was, I was a journalist for Mozambique, Radio Mozambique, state radio, and you could see clearly in some ways, with hindsight, of course, the authoritarianism and corruption and his use of power to...
Holy, I found a speech that Samora gave in 1982 or 81, I can't remember, in Beira, in which he said, "We have to be careful of those comrades who own their own homes. Where did they get the money from?" And he was talking about Gabuza.
Yeah.
And he was always worried about Gabuza. And there were all these rumors, I have no idea if they're true or not, of attempted coups by Gabuza or plans of coups. And we do know, though I have no idea whom, we do know, and as Auli would tell you, that there was complicity on the part of some people in the Frelimo government with the South Africans in terms of the death of Samora.
Yeah. I wonder, Alan, and go back, Doug talked about, you know, Frelimo following in some ways the strategy of Mao in China, becoming fish in the water in the rural areas. But, you know, a few years after independence, Frelimo turned itself into a vanguard party,
yes.
Marxist-Leninist party.
Yes.
These were the years, it lasted, I think, for about 10 years.
Oh, yeah.
They dissolved that. And I am wondering if you think that some of the corruption and the ossification that we see in more recent years, if it comes from people who wear state bureaucrats, functionaries who elevated themselves into mm-hmm. a special category and became removed from mm-hmm. what we could call the masses.
Right.
The
well, first of all, one thing that I only found out recently, and it's very important, Ali, is on June 26th, the day after independence, the first foreign delegation with whom Samora and the leadership met were the Chinese. And they brought with them a long laundry list of military equipment and that they needed, and also request for economic aid. And if you remember, this is still the end of the Cultural Revolution, and the Chinese said they couldn't do it. And the Chinese actually said, go to the Soviets. So Frelimo turned increasingly to Eastern Europe. East Germans, as you remember, they played a very important role. The East Germans, the Bulgarians worked on the state farms, the Soviets. And of course, in my judgment, the very best of the socialist allies were in fact the Cubans.
Yeah,
because they asked for very little, and they brought very much. I do think it's true that in the course of the decade of Samora, there was growing corruption, but he was able to contain the big corruption. Mm. What he couldn't contain was sort of the corruption, the small things that took place, the petty corruption. But it was the petty corruption, especially by state bureaucrats in important positions who took themselves much too seriously and began to promote their own class interests. And everyone has a million stories you could tell about this, that then creates a space and a culture once more dies and once everything becomes privatized and neoliberalism becomes the order of the day and the market.
I'm going to have to sort of try to wind this up a bit.
Sure.
We still have a few minutes left, but Uli, would you like to tell people why you think this is an important read?
Well, I think it's an important read because it brings back, look, one thing we should remember is that, you know, Samora is one in a long line of revolutionary leaders in Africa who have been assassinated by the enemy. Mm-hmm. We go to Lumumba, Amilcar Cabral, Ben Barka in Algeria, Thomas Sankara, and in South Africa, during just a few years we are discussing now, Ruth Hurst, Steve Biko, Chris Haney.
Chris Haney, yep.
These are, these are big, important leaders who were taken down by the enemy. And in Mozambique, in Southern Africa, that direct enemy was South Africa, certainly, it's the, and in colonial times, Eduardo Mondlane, we could call him the founder of Frelimo. But I think it brings back, you know, there are all these, we're talking about the big heavy duty issues here. But for those of us who lived there, you know, despite the many hardships, it's so full of warmth and humanity and interactions with people up and down the social scale, from, you know, the people who swept the street to, you know, my bosses in the ministries. Alan mentions Zamora would break into song in the middle of a 3-hour speech. And I was filming with the Cuban, I was there with the Cuban filmmaker, Santiago Alvarez. Mm-hmm. He was filming a Zamora rally, and Zamora breaks into song. And Santiago Alvarez says, Zamora better not come to Cuba and do this, because Castro couldn't hold the candle to his, mm-hmm. to his rallies, you know? And I think, you know, those are the things I have carried with me and will remember. And when I look at the tough situation today, the demoralizing situation in many cases, you know, that's why I think that what Zamora did for those years still stands up. It mm-hmm. holds up. It stands out.
So, Doug, can I just say,
Alan,
one thing?
If I could ask you to wrap this up with your summary of where you...
So here's what I think. Watching, since we're doing this on Zoom for your audience, watching Ollie smile, looking at his face, it reminds me of the camaraderie, but it also reminds me that this is possible, that the world that we live in now is not prefigured, although the balance of power has changed it dramatically. But 1975, if we could take everyone back to there, the world looked very, very different. And so the book, in some way, offers the hope to the Mozambican people and to younger generations that a new world can be constructed, a more socially just world than the world that we now live in. For me, it also has just been a joy to reconnect with Zamora's family, his kids, Grace and Michelle, and so many old comrades who helped in this book. So even though Bobby and I wrote it, it really is in many respects a collective work, and I hope people will enjoy reading it. And again, you can get it through Ohio University Press, or as you can get almost anything in these days through Amazon.
I want to thank you very much. And I must say, just looking at the pictures on the wall behind your head, I can see that this man has been a very important part of your life for a very, very long time.
He has indeed.
So I wish you very good night. I wish you very good luck with this book. It's been an amazing read. I can't say I have enjoyed a book as much in a long, long time, and learning things from it. And I hope we get a chance to talk again soon.
I hope so too. And as we would say in Mozambique, a luta continua, in South Africa, a mantla.
Oweto.
Oweto. Okay. Thank you.
Keep working, Alan.
Well, that's it, ladies and gentlemen, for Amandla this week. What you've been listening to is an interview with Alan Isaacman, co-author with his partner, Barbara Isaacman, of the book Mozambique's Zamora Michelle, A Life Too Short. A very interesting book. Highly recommended. Please do look it up and read it. For that matter,
I missed my cue there. So for that matter, please stay tuned now for Jazz Euphorium.
Did you get vaccinated?
Not yet, but I will soon.
And which one are you getting?
I'm getting the dance vaccine.
The dance vaccine? Great idea.
Yeah, rehearsing with the girls is what I miss the most.
Well, it's going to be the soccer vaccine for me. I can't wait to see the gang again.
Each vaccination brings us closer to these moments. Follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book an appointment at quebec.ca/COVID vaccine. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
The people's sound is calling. The Swanee Perry Popolo Music Festival is back and online with free jazz, noise, punk, new music, spoken word, electronic, avant-rock, sound art, and dance parties. Over 60 artists performing from Montreal, Chicago, Philadelphia, Sioux Lookout, Toronto, Mexico City, Brussels, Berlin, Tehran, Kampala, and Nairobi. Heed the call between June 3rd and 21st at SwaneePerryPopolo.org.